Today is Thursday, May 14th. We're going to jump out of the agenda just a little bit. The first two bills we're going to hear are Senate Bill 404A and 543A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 404A.
Senate Bill 404A repeals ORS 2160 and 2170, which I've pasted at the bottom of your summaries. They provide that attorneys of non-residents are liable to the defendant for costs awarded against their client. It declares an emergency and takes effect on passage.
Andrea Meyer. Andrea Meyer, please.
Yes.
Slightly ready, but I just it's my place.
All right.
Row four. Second one down.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director of the ACLU of Oregon, here today to bring you Senate Bill 404 that repeals ORS 20.160 and 20.170. And when you receive a copy of my testimony, it's on the back of the testimony. These are two laws that were enacted in 1862 and hold a plaintiff's attorney who represents either a non-resident individual or foreign corporation plaintiff personally liable for a cost judgment that's been awarded to the defense. This is not to be confused with the attorney fees. It's just the cost bill. Now, an attorney who represents a resident plaintiff or resident defendant is never held personally liable. And we believe this is disparate treatment between both resident and non-resident and raises constitutional concerns. No matter who provides a service to someone, a doctor, a lawyer, a business owner, if it is done in a professional and proper manner, the provider, the attorney, the business owner should not be held personally liable for the misdeeds of their client who fails to meet their personal obligation. A person is responsible for their debt, and they must and should be held responsible and pursued. Now, the reason we are bringing this bill to you to repeal this law is because we are actually challenging this law in court on the constitutional grounds. TriMet has gone after or is seeking $800 from an attorney who represented an out-of-state plaintiff. We only got involved to represent the attorney. And we have our proceeding in court. Now, I think the reason for the law 147 years ago is probably clear. It was very difficult to follow an out-of-state plaintiff for a judgment, for a cost. Transportation, communication, and the ability to and procedures for registering and enforcing a judgment in another state did not exist. They do right now, and I think that we can speculate may be the reason the legislative history no longer exists. We are asking that this be passed, and it does have an emergency clause provision, and it would apply to the current action. And the reason is, with resources at issue, we really would rather have a policy decision made and apply now than have the courts continue to litigate and state and local government resources be used on this. This passed almost unanimously on the Senate side and was carried by Senator Whitsitt on the floor. And ACLU respectfully ask that you pass Senate Bill 404. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? President Krieger.
It's been in
place
for 147 years. Why don't you just make, rather than non-residents liable, why don't you make all attorneys liable?
Well, I know.
That's the Krieger Amendment.
Yes, Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, we're happy to consider that if we do that for all, I don't know, government employees.
That gets rid of your constitutional problem.
Right. May or may not. I meant to mention, and my apologies, I also passed out a letter to you from the Oregon State Bar from the Procedure and Practice Committee. And that committee actually represents the civil bar in both plaintiffs and civil defense, and they are supportive of this as well. I think the attorney who is following me on another bill with us would testify, as many did, that most attorneys don't know this law exists. It's rarely invoked, but when it is, we think it's unconstitutional and we should move forward to the 21st century.
I point out, Mr. Chair, that if you vote with the Republicans, we outnumber the attorneys.
Notice that. Okay, thank you, Ms. Mark. Close the public work session, public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 404A.
Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 404 is amended to the floor but do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 404 as amended to the floor but do pass. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I think this is a great accomplishment for this committee and hope it'll pass the body that we're doing away with laws. I regret that it's to help lawyers again.
Beat up on lawyers day.
But I will
guess,
be a yes. But I will be a yes vote.
Did you say liars or lawyers?
Ooh. Wow. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
I guess.
Representative Olson.
Does that count?
Excuse.
Point of order, Mr. Chair. Does I guess count? Okay.
It rhymes, I guess.
Representative Olson.
Excuse.
Representative Shields.
Yes.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stevens.
Wholeheartedly, aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. And one of our fine attorneys carried that. Representative Stigler.
All over.
Okay, opening public hearing.
Let me carry it. Let me carry it.
Senate Bill 543.
He's being safe.
Now, Senate Bill 543A authorizes an immediate appeal of the denial of an anti-SLAPP motion. The amendment put in on the Senate side provides that this section shall be liberally construed in favor of defendants in a SLAPP suit. Just briefly, SLAPP is an acronym for suits filed by corporations or developers to scare citizens into dropping their protests. It stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. Oregon law currently allows someone who's been named as a defendant to bring a special motion to strike, which is treated like a motion to dismiss. The person bringing the motion to strike has to show that they've been protesting this corporation, and that's why they're bringing the suit. And then the burden shifts to the corporation to show that there is a valid claim. Right now, if the claim is denied, there's really not an avenue for appeal. What this bill does is changes the wording that the court enters the limited judgment, and that allows the defendant to make an immediate appeal.
Thank you. Let's fire Mr. Hinkle, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU, here today pleased to support Senate Bill 543 as an important free speech issue, and I will am happy to turn it over to Charlie Hinkle, a longstanding cooperating attorney with the ACLU.
Thank you. I'm Charles Hinkle. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 543. Your committee counsel has explained the bill very well, and I don't know that I need to take up the committee's time to beat this horse. I've submitted written testimony. The bill, the statute is working well. It was passed in 01. It just has this one little glitch in it that we think would solve the one remaining problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I used to practice with Mr. Hinkle, and I guess in summers in law school. He's among the state's more distinguished constitutional lawyers, and when I heard that he was testifying today, I really thought hard about how I can grill him and really take it to him to return the favor. Lord knows he's done it to me many times. And I could not come up with a principled way to oppose this bill. This strikes me as a no-brainer.
Any further questions?
Comment? There's an unprincipled way. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 543A. Open the work session on House Bill 543A.
Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 543 as amended to the floor but do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 543 as amended to the floor to do pass. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Excuse.
I'm using
the
one.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Barton, please.
Anyway.
Okay. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 371.
Senate Bill 371 provides corrections to the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. Most of the changes are technical fixes to the 2005 revision of the code, which updated Oregon's laws to comply with portions of the Model Uniform Code. Chris Klein from the bar is here to kind of walk you through the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Chris Klein. I am appearing as the past president of the executive section for the Estate Planning and Administration Committee of the Oregon State Bar. The bill that you have before you is largely technical corrections to the Uniform Trust Code, which was passed in 2005. This enacted a fairly sweeping change to the law of trusts in Oregon, and there were a few things that, given the scope of the bill, that we didn't quite get right the first time. So we've come back to correct some of those. There is one exception, there's one part of the legislation that is not technical in nature, that is actually an addition to the trust law, so I'd like to start with that. Often when people create trusts, they would like to appoint an advisor to the trustee. So, for example, if I appoint my brother to be the trustee to administer the trust, I might want my sister specifically to be in charge of one aspect of administration, distributions of property to my kids or something of that nature. Under current law in just about every state except Delaware, there isn't really any law on what their roles are vis-a-vis each other. That is, if my sister's not the trustee, is she still held to a fiduciary standard? Does the trustee still have the obligation to second-guess the decisions that she's made, notwithstanding what I've said in the instrument? And what Section 21 of this bill will do is clarify the ways in which you can create different roles with a trust arrangement. So you can appoint someone who is an advisor. That person has a fiduciary obligation unless you say otherwise. And the responsibilities of that person are not to be challenged by the trustee, nor is the trustee held liable for the decisions that that person has made. So that's the one change that is not, like I say, a technical correction. The next change involves the law of trust modification. Prior to 2005, you could, by unanimous consent of all parties, amend or terminate an otherwise irrevocable trust. So if the trustee and all the beneficiaries, current and remainder, agreed, you could change the terms in order to take into account unintended consequences, things that the person who created the trust couldn't have anticipated. And you could do that without going to court. So long as everybody agreed, you could do it by agreement. And that, by the way, is consistent throughout the Northwest. Idaho and Washington have similar laws. In 2005, we accidentally changed the law so that if the person who created the trust was no longer alive, you had to go to court to affect that kind of a change. And so what the change in Section 6 and 11 will do is take us back to where we were prior to the 2005 change, which is to allow all of the parties, even if the settlor is no longer alive, to modify or terminate a trust, again, with unanimous consent. With respect to that change, there's one thing that kind of came up on the Senate side that I'd like to bring to your attention. We've also, as we've made this change in the bill, we've also kind of moved some of the modification and termination provisions around a little bit so that they're all in one place. They were kind of spread out previously. And so you may notice in the bill that in some of the bolded text there's references to new procedural issues and new filing fees. They aren't actually new. They've just been moved from another place. So there is no economic consequence to this part of the bill or any part of the bill for that matter. The next sort of most important issue, it deals with notice. When we passed the Uniform Trust Code, we made clear by statute that if you were a trustee, you had to give annual notice to all beneficiaries who had a vested interest in the trust. So you had to let them know that it existed. You had to let them know that they had the right to get an accounting. That was sort of always the common law, but people weren't always clear about that, lawyers in particular. Unfortunately, when we adopted that, we allowed virtually everybody to have those rights, and the problem comes in with gifts that are small in nature. So, for example, I've got two kids, and I leave most of my estate to the good kid, and I cut out the other one. But common practice is to sort of leave them a dollar or $100 or something. You actually don't have to do that, but a lot of people do. Under the current law, I have to give the bad child the same rights to notice and everything that I have to give to the good one, and very often that beneficiary, just to be vexatious, will request an accounting, even though the gift of a dollar wouldn't generate the need for an accounting. So what this part of the bill does is provide that if you have a specific gift of property, that is a dollar amount or a particular piece of property, and you can satisfy that gift within 6 months, the rights to notice and to an accounting and so forth don't attach. So it's only if I can't get that gift satisfied within 6 months that person then becomes entitled to the same notice provisions. Finally, there are several smaller technical corrections. One clarifies the definitions of charitable trusts and revocable trusts. One clarifies the identity of the courts that have jurisdiction throughout the state, because in some of the less populous counties, it's not under the circuit court, and we had to clear up some of that language. There was one typo dealing with the court's ability to modify a charitable gift in order to keep it valid, so we're correcting that. And then we're correcting some cross-references to federal law. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You'll do trust.
Get out. Close the public hearing. Senate Bill 371, open work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westman.
Move Senate Bill 371 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Westman moves Senate Bill 371 to the floor with due pass. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Speaker? Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Take going to the consent
calendar.
Vice Chair
Spiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnitz?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Smith, would you
carry
that for us?
Happy to. He's going to do a consent.
Is there any objection to putting that on the consent calendar?
No objection to me.
Okay.
No.
Consent.
Good bill.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 235.
Yes, you have in your packets a hand engrossed bills with the dash one amendments. With the dash one amendments, the bill raises the limits on the value of an estate that can avoid probate and use the small estate provisions, changes it from $200,000 to $275,000 total. The amendments come from the bar who made the original proposal. They became aware that the property values were a little mismatched, focused more on the Portland area and not the rest of the state, and so the bar was happy to bring this reduction in the dash one amendments. You had a hearing on March 5th. The bar presented the goal was to reduce the burdens and costs of administering small estates. We did have an attorney who raised some concerns about adding estates to the small affidavit process would not allow them the protections that the probate provides. But the attorney said she has started a work group to bring legislation in 2011, which I think some of you asked for, to look at middle ground and possible follow Washington as a non-intervention probate statute. That's background.
We need to adopt the dash one.
That's right.
Okay. Chair.
Representative Westnett.
Council did, that was a good report, but so we had these a couple letters we got opposing.
That's right.
And that was because of the amount, so we people realize it's different values in the east and west.
Some of the opposition, you had a letter from Mr. Casey, and in his section four, he lists three concerns, protections that probate provides that wouldn't be provided to the small estates. For example, the court doesn't enforce to make sure that notice has been sent out to creditors. Apparently, it can be used to evade creditors. Accounting isn't required. Bond isn't required. That was a perspective offered. I think the bar's perspective is that the group that represents the section that presented the proposal disagreed with that group and perhaps their minority.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Westnett.
Move the dash ones into Senate Bill 235.
Representative Westnett moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 235. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
In a work session. Yep. Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 235 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Westnett moves Senate Bill 235 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Chair Wiggins?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. That one, Representative Smith, would you carry that, please?
Sure.
And over to work session on Senate Bill 561.
Yes, Senate Bill 561 was the bill brought by the Law Commission to create statutory guidelines for courts to use to govern conflict of law tort cases. You had the hearing April 30th. The dean testified. I think the dean's hiding back there. And the Law Commission, if you have questions, that's it. No amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barton.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate counsel's report. I would just like to note that it was actually, it does not apply to tort cases. It applies to non-contractual claims, which is not apply, and it's, I couldn't find it in Black's Law Dictionary or anywhere in Oregon Revised Statutes. I throw that out there because I think it's an interesting, potentially significant detail.
Yeah. Sorry, counsel. Wish we had the professor here to question it again.
He's doing his hobbies.
Discussion.
In slow motion.
This, we go to work session.
Yeah, we're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 561 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 561 to the floor of the due pass. For discussion, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Harris.
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I'm actually quite serious. I'd really prefer not to. I supported this, yes. I have a deep respect for the Law Commission, but I'm not yet, I don't feel...
Okay.
I've not been convinced of the need for this bill for me to stand up on the floor and tell my colleagues that they need to vote for this.
Sure.
Representative Garrow will carry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Barton. And we'll close that. We'll reopen Senate Bill 371. Representative, work session on Senate Bill 371. Representative Olson, how do you vote?
Yes.
Close it. Open a work session on Senate Bill 404. Representative Olson, how do you vote?
Yes.
Close the session. Open a work session on Senate Bill 543A. Representative Olson, how do you vote?
Yes. Thank you.
And reopen a work session on Senate Bill 235. Yes. Representative Olson votes yes. Thank you. Any further business to come before the committee? Adjourned.